Sportscast World Cup coverage on digital radio, on the app, on your smart speaker, on Twitter, YouTube, Twitch.tv, and Facebook. Sportscast World Cup coverage. Analyze and preview all the games of the World Cup here on the Sportscast. Sportscast World Cup coverage. And here's your host, Santiago Leon. Welcome to the Sportscast World Cup coverage, our final episode for this World Cup 22 Qatar. It is December 19th, 2022. If you haven't yet, please subscribe in all our channels, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, and Apple Podcast. You can also listen to us on your smart speaker. If you're listening on Apple Podcast, please leave a rating and a review. It will help us out tremendously. We're also on online radio, and you can visit us on the sportscast.net or download our app, the Sportscast for iOS. Argentina has won the World Cup finally after 36 years since Maradona won it for Argentina and Mexico in 1986. And join us all the way from the great up north, Maine, Hal Phillips, author of Generation Zero. Welcome back.
Thank you, Santi. It's always a pleasure.
What a great, great month of soccer. You trudged through it with us, the U.S., and now Argentina. As predicted, I predicted Argentina to win. Were you surprised of this outcome overall?
I guess I wasn't surprised. In the last podcast, you forced us to predict winners, and I was the only one to pick Argentina, I think, on the panel. So I'm pleased by that. And, you know, for 75 minutes, I mean, they looked unbeatable. And actually, the thought crept into my head that this French team was one that looked like they sort of missed Pogba and Kante and Benzema. And maybe we're a little tired, but I was wrong. What a finish.
Yeah, Argentina won in penalty shootouts, 4-2. But let's recap the goals. The first goal, Leo Messi scored in a penalty on the 23rd minute. Usually how that first penalty kind of messes up the opponent's head or like any team's head. But it came to be.
Oh, you mean it backfires on the team that scores
yeah.
it?
Messi, no, it really, I mean, like the team that was scored against, like France, it messes with you a little bit, doesn't it?
Well, they were curiously inert. I've read where people thought maybe they were just not over a bunch of viruses, you know, flus that they had within the team. That seems to make some sense. They could, you know, six games in that short period. That's a lot. They just looked listless. And Argentina looked anything but. They had that manic intensity that sets them apart from so many world-class sides. They were just everywhere. And Di Maria, you know, I'd forgotten he was even on this team. He played in the group stage. He was just okay. You sort of forgot he was on the squad, and then he shows up and was just brilliant. He set up that penalty by pulling a little Trae Young on the defender, who was Dembele, who was really not the guy you want defending anyone in the box, his defensive box. Di Maria just slowed down and took that impact, and was a beautifully drawn penalty and perfectly executed by Messi. And we have to say, you can't spell Messiah without Messi.
Exactly. Then in the 36th minute, Di Maria, as Hal was mentioning, was in the starting lineup. Kind of a surprise. He didn't start against Croatia, but he did, made an impact, and scored in 36th minute. It was like a Messi orchestrated that goal. He passed to McAllister, and then McAllister, you know, put it towards the middle. Di Maria was there, shot it in. And I thought at that moment how Argentina was going to win the World Cup.
I didn't think that, but I thought that once we got to that 2-0 point, the next goal would tell. You know, if Argentina scored the third one as they did against Croatia, that kills the match. But if they give one up, France is obviously right back in the game, and it's sphincter time for Argentina. But, you know, that's not what happened. The goal itself was gorgeous. Messi set it up on the right side, and McAllister, who I thought really grew in this match into a world-class midfielder, Brighton has got to be very well pleased to have seen his progress in this tournament, laid a perfect ball across to Di Maria, who you know, couldn't have missed it. I think you could have scored that one, Santi.
Yeah. Coach Scaloni, coach of Argentina, I think has used these players very different from the past Argentina managers I've noticed. And he, you know, recruited McAllister, the Paul players that wasn't in the plans of the Argentinian team, but he definitely had some good tactics and it's worked out so far. Then second half, I honestly, it was going towards the 80th minute, right? And I was thinking, okay, I guess Argentina's going to win it. France looks pretty weak. They're not going to do anything. A penalty happened in favor of France. That motivated France right there, scored by Mbappe. And then a minute later, Hal, Mbappe equalized, which I thought was the best goal of the match. Some people say it was the other one with Di Maria. Mm-hmm. But that was class from Mbappe.
It was amazing how little he had done up to that point. And if we go back two matches to Croatia and their round of 16 match or their quarterfinal match again against England, you know, he was fine. He didn't play badly, but he didn't impose himself on the match in any way. He waited until this time to do it. Just to go back to the Argentina story, I had the same feeling. 75 minutes into this game, you're just like, this is just not going to happen. Argentina was getting better and better as the match went. They didn't look nervous. They kept attacking, which I thought was just brilliant tactics. It's really, really hard to stay attacking as a side up 2-0 in a game this important. Your natural inclination is to sit back a little bit, and that's usually when the trouble comes. That is not what happened here. For such a young team that ran out for Argentina, they played brilliantly. And they, they subbed off Di Maria. I keep calling him Di Maria, my bad. Di Maria went off after, 70 minutes or something like that?
I believe it was right before that goal. And it was the 64th minute for Marcus Acuna.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone, I didn't look at that and say, oh, now let's see what's happening. They were so dominant in their midfield where, you know, Di Maria is sent down on the left. It was not any kind of crisis point or poised moment there. I thought they were just going to continue to do what they did. And they did do that. They just kept dominating and they kept going forward with that manic intensity. I didn't see a way for France back into this match, but goals change games, even penalties, which, you know, aren't necessarily in the run of play and can be quite fortunate, as I thought that one was. But man, all of a sudden it's 2-2, and all of a sudden the people that I was texting with were like, how come Argentina doesn't have more guys on? They're clearly tired. Well, no one thought that 5 minutes before, that they were tired and that they were losing their grip on this game. That just was not evident. And I think that the Argentinian coach made a decision that he was going to get to the finish line with this group. I think they made one more sub, so they only used two, and they ended up using two more subs in the overtime, which I think turned out to be the right move. It's very difficult to, you're trying to hold on to a game and you don't want to bring on everyone you've got. That's going to completely change the chemistry on field. And they hung on and got away with it because this was a completely different match going into overtime.
Yeah. And this reminded me a lot of the Holland match where Argentina was up 2-0 and they Holland scored in the 80th minute. So very similar matches here. Wegwerst, and then he scored the equalizing goal, right? I think it was like 1 minute before the match was going to end.
Yes.
So we went to extra time, and Argentina scored in the 108th minute. Leo Messi did. And the ball went past the line, and there was a French defender inside the goal. He kicked it out, but thank God for goal line technology. The watch rang in the ref, and it was a goal.
Yeah, it was interesting to think back on that Dutch match because I don't remember the overtime, the extra time having so much action in it. There were chances up and down the field during this overtime, especially the second period. And when Argentina had scored, it was presumed again. Here's another winner. Now they've won it again, and it's Messi. And oh my goodness, how perfect! And boom, another penalty is called and we're tied up again. And you just can't imagine that Argentina is going to come back from this emotionally. But they are incredibly resilient, obviously. And again, there was so much going on and I had so much to drink so early in the morning. It's hard to recall it all. But the saves that Martinez made, or Emilio it's right. Emilio Martinez is the Argentinian keeper.
Quite a character.
He made some extraordinary saves off Mouani, Kola Mouani, who had come on for France. Do you have the changes there for France? I'm working on it, looking on a small.
Yeah, screen. Yeah. Mouani, let me look it up. He came in.
There
in
we
the
go.
41st minute for Usama Dembele. Yeah, which Deschamps made two subs before halftime. Quite interesting.
Well, they Rabiot came off late, but they also brought on Kingsley Coman, you know, for Griezmann, who had been their best playmaker throughout this tournament. That was pretty ballsy. And then Camavinga, who came on, you know, out of position to play on that left back, but he's not a left back. He's an attacking midfielder, but he really helped turn the game around. Not necessarily in the 71st minute when he came on, but in the overtimes, I thought he was outstanding. Deschamps gets great marks from me. I mean, he was quite lucky to have been the recipient, of some brilliance by Mbappe, and the penalty is a penalty. But in the overtime, I thought his substitutions made a huge difference in this game. They had the upper hand when this game had finished. If you think about it. The first 75 minutes of this game were one game. And then the last 35 minutes or 45 minutes were a completely different game. And that second 45, really, the French were better. They outscored the Argentinians, who also had chances to score. So it was a back-and-forth affair over the last 45 minutes, something you never see in a match of this kind of import. Usually, teams get exhausted and more cautious the bigger the match. This one just got wilder. And again, it's hard to keep it all straight in retrospect.
Yeah, some say it might have been the best match, best World Cup final ever, obviously debated. Good points on Coman. Coman definitely helped change the game for France. And then after that one goal by Messi, Mbappe was awarded another penalty. France was awarded a whole nother penalty at the 118th minute, which was right before penalties for full relegation for extra time. Scored it 3-3. That was a great match. And then penalties happened.
Well, I thought it was interesting that Paulo Dybala was subbed in. An extremely prestigious player, isn't really getting the run at Juventus that he would like, but had barely been seen in this tournament. I think he came on late in the Croatia game as well, but came on for a penalty, made his penalty. And, Emilio Martinez was just amazing. Although I thought he should have been carded for unsportsmanlike conduct. You can't basically shithouse, the opposing shooter in the way that he did a couple of times. And I don't know why the ref, who I thought was outstanding for the most part, didn't card him, because how are you supposed to stop that guy from doing it? If you're not going to card him, you can't threaten him, with sending off, which I thought was an order if he kept it up. And there has to be some kind of decorum with regard to the penalties. And we've seen some issues here. That was why the Dutch and the Argentinians got so very pissed at each other, because they were talking all sorts of smack in the center circle and really making a nuisance of themselves during the penalty kicks in that quarterfinal.
Yeah, he also did some a little bit of a crude thing with one of the trophies, the Golden Glove trophy. I was like, "What?" Even the announcers, "Oh, you shouldn't do that," or something. They said.
So, well, these are young men, and if I was held accountable for everything I did when I was 24, we'd all be in trouble.
And how often do you win the World Cup, right?
So. Yeah, exactly. I was never put through that, but so I have even less of an excuse. But that was. Poor form.
I loved it. So then, of course, in the penalty shootout, all the Argentinians made their goals. France did not. Kingsley Coman from France missed, and also Chimani missed. So Argentina had experience with penalty shootouts. So France was like, this was like their first of all tournament. So, which I think it made a difference.
I guess so. I mean, it's such a different team at that point when they're choosing up sides. I think they brought Konate on to shoot. I'm not sure he got a chance to shoot. I can't remember now. But it was such a different pool of players. I mean, Camavinga and Mouani and Coman, you know, that's the attacking core of your group now, along with Mbappe for the, you know, almost the entire overtime. And you know, I thought they were great. It just shows you how deep that team is. But when it comes to choosing up penalties, it's a crapshoot. Some of the best players out there don't want any part of it. And they obviously have sorted it out. I mean, I think they made a point to say that the French have only ever been involved in 5 shootouts, like in the modern era. So obviously not very much. But, you know, what do you carry forward from a shootout against the Dutch? I mean, just the fact that you persevered, I guess, would help you. But I thought the Argentinians never wavered in their belief that they were going to win this game. They never let it get to them. And they fell behind. They really had to win it 3 times. So
it's quite something. Third World Cup. And that's what happened. Argentina won the penalty shootout. Messi, as you see in the screen share here, won the World Cup. He had an interesting outfit that the Qataris gave him. It was interesting. And World Cup for the 3rd time. I mean, I wasn't around for 86 or 78, but they finally did it. And also 20 years since the last South American team to win it. So this is something.
I always thought that Brazil and Argentina were favored to win this tournament because of where it was held. No South American team has won in Europe since 1958. And that's just a long, long list of evidence right there. And the last one to win a World Cup was Brazil, again, on neutral ground, if you will, in Japan. So I think it really does. These continental politics do matter. So I'm not surprised that Argentina won. They were one of my tournament favorites. Interesting to me, you know, when you see, you know, when was the last time we saw a World Cup winner presented with an outfit, you know, to wear around the, I mean, the Qataris really sort of, they wanted to put their stamp on this game and this tournament in a very real way. They did it, you know, with their banning the booze in the stadiums, and they are unapologetic about these things. I mean, they pissed a lot of people off with these gestures, but for whatever reason, FIFA, who usually comes in and rules FIFA land, you know, in a host country with an iron fist, didn't do that. They really let the Qataris rule in a lot of ways. And I'm not sure that's a great thing going forward. I think that Saudi Arabia is looking at the 2030 World Cup, which has not been announced yet. And they're saying, you know what? I think maybe we should do this. And FIFA will let us do what we want, basically. And we don't have to worry about how many people die in the building of stadia, because obviously the Qataris got past that. And mark it down. I think that Saudi Arabia is going to be a final ballot favorite for 2030.
Strong possibility. Other countries like Spain are vying for that hosting bid. Also Uruguay and a couple of others.
I think it's Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay. And that would be, I think, the best choice, because South America hasn't hosted in a long time. And Ecuador has already bailed on the 2024 Copa America. So, yeah, I definitely think it should go to the Global South. And South America is due. And Argentina is probably favored if that happens.
Yeah, hopefully 100th anniversary of the World Cup. Yes. Also, besides the World Cup trophy handed, there was also other awards. Golden Boot, Kylian Mbappe with 8 goals. So he won the Golden Boot Award. The Golden Ball, which is the best player at the World Cup tournament, Lionel Messi was awarded that. Golden Glove, Emiliano Martinez with that gesture he did with the trophy, quite something. And then young player of the tournament, Enzo Fernandez. Some people thought it could have been Julian Alvarez, but didn't happen. And the FIFA Fair Player Award was awarded to England.
Oh, I did not know that. Did they have the fewest yellows?
Apparently. I think that's how they won.
How about that? I'm sure they're pleased.
So those were the awards, and most of the Argentinians won it. But recapping this World Cup, I think we saw a lot of new things. You know, obviously, the Asian countries did fantastic. The Arab countries, the African countries as well. Which team surprised you the most in this tournament, Hal?
Well, it had to be Morocco. They played brilliantly. I think they did have a home court advantage, as it were, and they took full advantage of it. But that, again, is part of what these politics offer and mean. And that's why people seek them. It makes a difference where these tournaments are played. Europe sort of feels entitled to the tournament every other, you know, quadrennial, and I get it. Because I think we need to address the fact that that's not just where all the money is. I mean, in the developed soccer world, if you exclude North America for a moment, because it's sort of hard to see where we stand in that rubric, you know, that's where the money is that drives this game. But just as important, Europe is the place where all of the world-class players are sent to train themselves up. Yes, they are purchased, but if you want to develop a good team in this, you know, in a World Cup caliber team, and I've been writing about this, you know, just over the weekend, you know, you need to get your players into Europe's European systems, playing for clubs there. That's what the United States has finally done. That's what France did with all of these African folks who are either born in France to, you know, to newly arrived citizens of France, or grew up in Africa itself. They have brought, you know, these players to Europe, not just French clubs, but European clubs generally. This is where the action is and the money is in Europe. And of course, the same thing is true of Argentina and Brazil. They send their best players to Europe to be sold off and also trained up. So I don't begrudge, it's a long way of saying, I don't begrudge Europe getting the World Cup every other quadrennial, but you have to move it around. And for that reason, I think Qatar was an excellent host. But unfortunately, I think that's the only reason that Qatar was an excellent host. And the success of this World Cup, I think, makes it a little too easy for us to, again, look past the fact that this is an authoritarian government and they sort of, you know, bullied everybody into getting the event and were terrible and mistreated their own, you know, workers in building of all these stadia, and showed very little concern for them even now. And, you know, if you can't shame them now, I don't know who can be shamed ever.
Yeah. Future tournaments, of course, with the new regime, we'll see how things are processed. You know, for 2030 would be the big test of how, you know, with Infantino and the new FIFA council members, we'll see how they decide for the next World Cup. I have to agree with Hal. I think Morocco was the surprising team. Other surprises that I thought in this World Cup was Germany bowing out early, Belgium. A couple other teams, you know, that could have done better, obviously, but in the round of 16, we saw a little bit more of flair, a little bit of diversity, I guess you can say.
Well, I should have said, I don't mean to interrupt, but, you know, I forgot that we were talking about surprising teams. I think the last 16 showed it's a very closed group when you're talking about World Cup capable sides. Only 8 countries have ever won it. If you get rid of England and Uruguay, you know, only 6 really have done it in the modern era. So we're talking about a very small group of countries that are capable of winning it. I don't know that we see anybody entering that elite class, but there are lots more very capable sides that I noticed at this World Cup that I think we can call new. I think the U.S. is part of that group. Everyone seems to think they're a coming force, and I can't disagree. Japan, unbelievable. They took out the Germans and the Spanish, and did it with real technical flair. I mean, this is not a pack it in grunt side. They go for it. They score goals. They're athletic. They're incredibly fast and fit. So they were as impressive as Morocco, I thought. And I think that I had another one that I thought.
Denmark.
Oh, I thought Portugal. Again, Portugal is really the most capable of making that next step. If Portugal played in the final of this tournament, no one would have been surprised. They're loaded, and they've been very good for a long time. They've won a European championship. They're not any kind of newcomer. So that immediately expands the pool of potential quarterfinalists by almost half. So that's very exciting. I think that we may look back on this World Cup as the last of an era because of the move to 48 teams.
Yeah.
Because of what I think will be a much easier qualifying process for big clubs. They've sort of super leagued. The idea, I mean, I can't see Italy missing out again, because it's going to be just that much easier to qualify because half again, as many teams will qualify. Africa will get more spots, I'm sure. I guess, will CONCACAF get one? I don't know. But surely more European teams will have a chance to go because they've already accounted for more, you know, more slots than anyone else in the field.
Yeah, you brought up a good point of, you know, the new era. And one other point that I want to bring up again is, you know, with the U.S. and, you know, we had a great roster, a great squad of a lot of them playing in Europe. And you're right. We got to continue these players to go to Europe and gain that experience, you know, and playing game to game out. I think that's one step. And now that the U.S. is going to get Copa America, that's also a great step for us to get experience.
Huge.
With international football. So that's something we got to continue going. What do you want to see for the U.S. in the next couple of years? I know we don't have qualifiers, so we got to take every big tournament or every game very important.
Well, I've just written something that I'm going to put up on my book's companion site, then, and that's at www.genzero.halphillips.net. It'll be up today. And it's really about how little Greg Berhalter will, you know, how little effect he will have on the shaping of this team. An amazing core. I don't think we've ever had such a good core of young players. I mean, I can reel off 9 names here. They're all 24 years old or less. But again, the most important thing about that group is they're all playing in Europe. They're all going to be trained day to day by seasoned coaching staffs. And they're going to get the best training possible. If they were playing in MLS, I love MLS, but that would not be true. So they're doing what they have to do. What Berhalter does with them when they show up in camp is just not relevant. As badly as you think Gio Reyna was betrayed by Berhalter, and I generally don't think that that's the case, but even if you do feel that, you have to admit that there's just going to be, you know, the progress of this group of players has nothing to do with Berhalter. When they show up for a tournament, he's in charge of deploying them in a canny and tactical way, and that does matter, but that won't matter until the Copa America in 2 years. I hope he steps down. I would like to get someone else in here that then maybe when they do show up in camp can lend them a little tactical poise and nuance that I just don't know that Berhalter is capable of. Generally I think the outlook is super bright, but I think, you know, if Berhalter is re-signed, then I think we're going to have him through the Copa America, and I would rather not have that myself. Who comes in his place, I don't know. But I guess I want to hearken back to the USMNT coach that preceded Berhalter. Klinsmann. No great fan of Klinsmann. I thought he actually produced a lot of blood from a stone from that team in 2014. That was not a great group, and tactically he deployed them very well. But remember all the shit that Klinsmann gave those guys from coming back from Europe and playing in MLS in 2015 when MLS was starting to get a little better and dropping some money? Klinsmann was trying to tell them something, and he was trying to tell us something. If you want to be good, you got to go to Europe and get trained up. That's how players become world-class in this game. The players themselves, I don't think they listened to him. The fans didn't necessarily listen to him. But you know who listened to him? Pulisic. Sergiño Dest. Aronson. Reyna. All those guys went straight to Europe as quickly as they could arrange it. They got the message. And no one else was beating that drum like Klinsmann was in 2015. So a tip of the cap to Klinsy.
Yeah, Klinsmann actually really did a great job, to be honest, back in the day. I think he did a lot of recruitment and all that. And I agree with you. I think Berhalter, I think, laid the foundation for this squad. And I think we need to go to the next level. There's one article that I cannot forget was well written. How Mark Jackson led the Warriors, you know, like these. I mean, he helped them, but then the Warriors got another coach, Steve Kerr, and took him to the next level. So we need that coach that will take us to the next level. It could be a European coach or someone from within. I don't know. I don't have all the answers there.
Well, I just don't think that national team coaches take groups of players to the next level. Players do that. And how do they do that? They do that by playing for good clubs and getting training and competitive, you know, tempering at the highest levels. And then when they come to camp, you know, hopefully that the manager is savvy enough to deploy them in a way that is, you know, simple. These are all-star teams. They don't play together. They play very simple systems compared to their club alignments and schemes. So it's a wholly different exercise. Again, I don't want Berhalter to be the guy who coaches his team for the next 2 years, but if he does, it's not going to kill the program. The idea that we have all these guys who are already there, are so young, they're going to be that much better and that much more savvy in 4 years' time. And oh, by the way, there's going to be a whole other crop of guys who will come up behind these guys that we don't even really know yet. Or I know that I don't, only a couple names. So I think that the future is very bright, and I hope that Chris Richards and Miles Robinson are also healthy for the next World Cup, because Walker Zimmerman and Tim Ream are going to be too old and slow.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. You're right. In 4 years, we could have a couple different people on this roster that we don't know of yet.
Several. Could be half a dozen.
Absolutely. I've seen this, Hal, all the time. Oh, yeah, we're going to see the same players. No, there's always going to be at least half or whatever percentage that would be a different roster. It's hard to have the identical roster every 4 years. This is impossible. Yeah. Yeah. But anyways, that was the World Cup. I enjoyed it. Hal enjoyed it. We got 3 years and a half till the 2026 World Cup. A lot going to go on. There's some motivation. The Winter World Cup, I didn't think it was a bad idea, but I'd like to see what happens when the clubs go back into play, like the Premier League and La Liga, how everything scopes out. I have to see the whole picture first, and then I can judge if the Winter World Cup was a good idea or not. Not exactly is going to happen again unless a whole nother Middle Eastern country hosts, but we'll see what happens. Anyways, Hal, tell us about your book, Generation Zero.
Well, if you're wondering how America actually started mattering at World Cups, this is the book that tells the story. It's a unified theory of really how we got here as a proper soccer nation. The team there featured on the cover, that's the 1990 U.S. men's national team. They're the first ones to qualify for a modern World Cup, and everything flowed from there. So, pick it up. And notice that today, you know, online you can see who's reading, you know, pages, sample pages from the book. Massive uptick in interest in the book just because of the World Cup that was played yesterday. I can see it in real time. It's a freak. But definitely pick it up via Amazon or barnesandnoble.com, and I think you will enjoy it. If you're an American soccer fan, it is right up your alley.
And yes, you can see the link right below in the description if you want to purchase it. It's only started, this thing all started about 25 to 30 years ago. And I listen to Tony Meola sometimes, like, man, he was one of the founding fathers, kind of, you can say. It's just interesting how we got into like a whole long way from there. So, and what is the best way to reach you online for any questions?
I tweet from at Mandarin Hal. Let me give you the address of that companion site. Again, it's gen0halphillips.net. And I also blog at just halphillips.net. That's all my non-soccer stuff is over there. But yeah, drop me a line, and it's going to be I'd be interested too, Santi, to see just how the players in the Premier League, for example, react. They could start dropping like flies. I mean, they got games Thursday.
True. Injuries could creep up once they come back.
I'd be shocked if they didn't, unless they load manage the hell out of these guys, which, you know, I'm an NBA guy, and load management is just killing me. Trying to watch the NBA regular season just does not matter much anymore. I hope that doesn't creep into proper club football.
And you can see the address on the video if you're watching this, generation0.halphillips.net. And Hal, we'll probably have you back when the Gold Cup happens in June and also July, or maybe some Nations League. It will depend which tournament is more important, depending on the roster.
Well, you know where to find me, Santi. It's always my pleasure to join you on the Sportscast.
Absolutely. And you can follow us at thesportscast.net or thesportscast1 on Twitter. That's it with the World Cup. Now we get into the NFL college football. and things get a little bit crazy there as well. But anyways, Hal, I appreciate you coming on this past month. You have been one of the best, and I hope to see you again soon.
You know where to find me. Always a pleasure.
And that was your Up the World Cup coverage.